Welcome back. This is the Road Trip Playlist Podcast. I am Thomas Darrow, and I am your host. I'm so excited about this week's episode. My guest is the incredible Kishi Bashi. Kishi Bashi is one of my favorite artists of all time. He's been on my interview bucket list for a very, very long time, and is one of the best concerts that I've ever seen live. We talk a little bit about that concert in this interview today. I'm excited for you to hear this episode. We talk about his new EP, Emigrant, if flunking out of Cornell was the best thing to ever happen to him, how he got his start on tour with Regina Spektor, and more. Stay tuned after a quick word from our sponsor. Thanks.
Perfect. Okay, I'm recording. Yep.
Okay, awesome. Well, I have to tell you, this is a true pleasure for me because you've been top of my bucket list. I have a note in my phone of bucket list interviews, and Kishi Bashi is in the top five probably of people that I want to talk to. And so this is really cool. It's called the Road Trip Playlist Podcast, and no music goes along better to some of the drives that I've done than Kishi Bashi. So it's a pleasure to have you.
Thanks. It's great to be the Machu Picchu of your bucket list interviewees. You know, that's on my bucket list. I already went there last year, but
okay, that's amazing. I like to start off by asking where it is the Road Trip Playlist Podcast. What is on your Road Trip Playlist Podcast? What's on your Road Trip Playlist?
My Road Trip Playlist. Okay, my daughter, I have a 15-year-old, and I've done road trips with her. Her playlist is vastly different than mine. does not include any of my songs, of course. I don't know. I do like a lot of classic rock, you know, and funk. Stuff I'll jump between that and like contemporary stuff, and then I also listen to a lot of podcasts, like not music, you know, about science and stuff.
Yeah, okay, same here. What's a podcast you've been listening to?
I mean, I love Radiolab, and I listen to This American Life too. Definitely wait Don't Tell Me. Basically, okay. Any NPR thing. I'll
So good. That's actually how I was introduced to you, oddly enough, is NPR a few years ago. So that's cool. Awesome. But I saw that you recently, like you mentioned your road trip with your daughter, you guys went on a road trip of your own. And I wanted to ask, how was that? Because, you came home with some songs for your recently released EP.
I mean, it's amazing. Like I got to see, you know, cause if you're touring a lot, you go to the major cities and you don't really get a chance to see nature that much.
Yeah.
You know, so this time, you know, I went through like South Dakota and places. Well, I'm sure a band's playing in South Dakota, but not in the Black Hills, you know, like where Mount Rushmore is and stuff, you know. So I got to camp out and really see America, like the raw wilderness, you know, a lot, which is something you don't, you know, you tour as a musician, you tour, but you don't get to see a lot of that. You don't have that luxury sometimes.
Totally. And you were writing along the way. Was this planned that you were gonna, that it was gonna be inspiration for your EP, or did that just happen?
I think it's a combination of both. You know, I'm a firm believer that, you know, inspiration can strike anywhere. So it's, you just always, as long as you're content and happy and sometimes bored, you know, so like that's the best way for your mind to start playing, you know, so I'm always receptive to that.
Absolutely. I love that so much. And I've been obsessed since you released the new Emigrant EP. It's a sister project to Omoyari. I wondered if you had planned to have these work as companions before, or if it just kind of happened with this road trip.
I think it's definitely a continuation of, you know, using history to inspire songs. So in that aspect, it's a companion piece, but you know, I went way folkier with this album. So that's definitely, as a music thing, I don't know. It's a departure in my head, at least.
Yeah, absolutely. I read about how some of that folk in the bluegrass kind of instrument or influence came from like remembering something you studied at Berklee College with the 60s and 70s Japanese bluegrass scene. And I thought how that tied together was really cool.
Yeah, that's I mean, I remember my old teacher mentioning, he's like, you know, there's a lot of like skilled, like burning bluegrass players in Japan. I'm like, nah. I don't believe you, but and I looked it up and they're just as good as anybody else, you know? And it's just interesting. I think like 20 years later, like now that I'm like, oh, maybe I don't have to be from Kentucky, you know, to play bluegrass music or stuff like that.
Absolutely. And I've loved the overall sound of the album and how it came together. Can you explain kind of how you ended up choosing to go with the bluegrass folky sound that you did?
Well, I relied a lot on my musicians this time, which is something it takes me a while, you know, to get used to letting other musicians not dominate, but at least like contribute to the extent that they have. And so I had some awesome, you know, this banjo player, Tall Trees, who I've toured with, but never really recorded with, you know?
And so, interesting.
Yeah. And so it's like, hey, you play banjo. Why don't we just go all full mountain on this music, you know? and he was happy to do that. And I had some other great musicians, Cicada Rhythm, and then a cellist. And I decided to do no drums. So it's kind of like, that's how the sound evolved.
Yeah. Wow. It's so interesting. I was curious. I related very much so. I was reading an interview of yours and you talked about collaborating and working with other artists. And one of the things was that it's like, you've done a lot by yourself because of just being self-conscious of your work and people not kind of getting it the way that you do. And I am that way so much. And so how has it been since early in your career doing and the live show being a lot of solo looping and all that to now, as you said, Tall Trees, that was it was the best concert I've ever been to when I saw you in Salt Lake City.
Wait, did you see it when it was just crazy wild people just jumping up and down and screaming?
That was it. October 3rd, 2019.
Last year. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was probably the wildest show of, there's a lot of, I think there's a lot of like sober Mormon energy in the crowd that was just pushed it to the limit of the roof, you know, the energy level. And it was not, I've never ever seen a show like that with that kind of enthusiasm. So you saw something really special that night.
Yeah. You kept saying that it was the best all tour. And
it was, I say that a lot.
Yeah. That's what I was wondering. I'm like, oh, I figured that was that. So it's cool hearing, cause that night was just so special. It was one of like, I wrote about it that night and it was just such a beautiful experience with your music. I was like moved and frequently go back to Violin Tsunami on my videos. I go back that night because I was really moved when you did that show. The opener, Takenobu, was so good that night. So it was one of the best shows I've ever seen. And so
I think we played like Violin Tsunami in the audience.
Yes.
Maybe, right? Yeah, that's like a special thing I can only do when I have the Takenobus, you know, because Catherine, the violinist, is amazing. So
it was so good. So I love that you remember that show being just as good. And yes, it was a Mormon sober energy all throughout the night. And there was jumping.
It was crazy. I mean, yeah, it was a really special moment. Yeah.
But yeah, so what is it like? Because I loved the collaboration of that night, as you talked about Catherine with Takenobu with the violin, Tall Trees. I was right in front of him as he was playing like the banjo with a violin string, and it was insane. And Pip the Pansy, all these people, where it was incredible. And so how has it been from going from kind of the solo stuff to all now opening up and doing the collaboration?
Yeah. I mean, if you look at my progression, I basically had a rock band in the 2000s and then I basically brushed it all clean, you know, kind of the band broke up and then I started solo. And so I built from that. And so in the beginning it was just me. And then I had this motto of like, don't lose money on tour. And so I kind of, I had to, well, but you know, if you're solo, you can't, it's really hard to lose money if you're just one person, you know? And so I started with that motto and Mike was my first hire, Tall Trees. And then I kind of built it from there. But I know a lot of people kind of like to see me do my solo stuff. So even when I have a larger band, I always reserve a portion of the show so that I can do a couple solo songs just by myself. And then
yeah,
that's part of the arc of the show.
I loved the balance of that and wanted to make sure that I noted that. Cause when I was reading the Reddit AMA you did, and also this, it seemed like I had never been to a
purely solo one. And then I loved the collaboration, and I also loved the balance of when you were, when it was just you. And so I love that you do make time to do both.
Oh yeah. And I love to feature the musicians too. Like if I have, you know, oh, you can play flute. Oh, you can do this and oh, you can do that. You know, I like to feature, like Mike plays, he's an awesome bass player, you know, Tall, Tall Trees.
Yeah.
He's playing bass for like probably half the show, but before he barely ever played bass, you know, and he's like, oh yeah, you can slap bass. You listened to Primus in the 90s. So why don't we have a little slap bass section here for you? I think we did a little slap bass.
That was one of the things I noted in my article that you wrote. Part of the thing that I think added to the magic of that night and the beauty of that night.
Slap bass.
was how much you celebrated all of the artists that were there. It was a perfect collection of that. So, but yes, the slap bass was part of that.
I think that's when I crowd surf.
Yep, it was.
Slap bass solo, and I got this crane. It was. Yeah.
You have your motto, don't lose money on tour. I have a motto for all you can eat buffets, don't lose money at buffets. And so yours is probably much smarter than mine.
Does anybody lose money at buffets? Like the person who doesn't want to go to a buffet, who just doesn't want to eat that much, probably loses money at a buffet, right?
Yeah, they're there for one. I mean, I always feel like I lose money at a buffet. Like my dad trained me poorly. It was like, he was an alcoholic, never had money, but when we would visit his house this weekend and he was taking us anywhere, you could tell it was like a big deal, because it was one of the only times, especially like, that we ate good when we went to his house for the weekend. Well, and so
wait, but did you get that's the only time you ate good? What sorry that you were
I wasn't meaning hungry. I was like, oh, should hungry. I say this or should I not? Yeah. But
now, well, do you have it down to a science? Like how many plates do you need to eat to make up to beat the buffet house?
Oh, that's what I should work on. I should work on some sort of algorithm that it's like, okay, this is how you want. But I think once you just get you have to try a little bit of everything. So you get like your favorites on each dish. Mm. At the time for this breakfast buffet, they had these money hash browns. And so I had to keep the hash browns on each dish, but then I would try like the eggs or this. It's been a while since I've been to a buffet, and it seems weird after a pandemic even going to a buffet and serving myself that way. But that's one of my mottos. Don't lose money on a buffet or a season pass. If I buy a season pass anywhere, game over. I'm doing like 10 trips.
Wait, so how much is a breakfast buffet? I feel like that's kind of intense.
Like 15, 16. It depends where you are.
$16?
I live in New York now. Utah was probably like $8.
Yeah. Even like for $16. Well, actually New York is just nuts, but
yeah. I'm like, oh,
$16. You got to eat a lot of huevos. You know,
exactly.
To get that money back.
But yeah, you have to do it. So, but yeah, so that's one of my mottos that I had to share with you. But I had noted we're approaching the 2-year anniversary of Omoyari, and it's such a powerful and important album. It was praised as being a profound empathy by NPR, like we talked about NPR earlier. What was that process like creating the album for you and learning the history of these Japanese American internment camps more like at the level that you did, and while seeing similar things going on in the world today, that had to be kind of heavy?
I mean, it was a long stretched out process of, you know, I'm still working on this movie. The companion piece to the album is actually the movie. And so of the same name. And it's a stretched out process of, you know, just really learning a lot of history, going to locations, talking to survivors, kind of getting getting a modern context of how this is shaped, you know, our society, or how it's not shaped our society, and we're still making the same mistakes again. But I think, all along the time, you know, I'm also touring, and it's just a lot of very measured growth on my end. That's the way I see it. You know, I grew as a human being, as I learned about like the awful things we continue to do to each other, you know, and then, but all the while making music. And so a lot of my music, the songs, some of them are, you know, at first when you're talking about an injustice, you know, you think it's all negative, but A lot of my songs are really positive, and so I liked a lot of times I like to focus on, you know, finding the humanity in all these situations, or like how we are, you know, being grateful for, you know, our place now, you know, as opposed to being incarcerated unjustly in the past. And so I don't know, it's a long process, but I actually don't remember what your question was, but
no that's perfect. Absolutely. And that's one of the things that I think you do beautifully is turn it to kind of more hope filled. And I'm thinking of times when I've written things that were heavier and it took me to a place that was like, while I was working on this piece, where it was kind of hard and it was like, wow, this is terrible. And so now that it's like, I think the way that you've turned that and flip it and the growth that you experience and also present in your art is incredible. And I wanted to ask about the film. What can you tell me about the film with its release as the companion with the song film and as the true companion to the album?
Yeah, I mean, the idea of song film was that they were supposed to be released together, but movie, you know, albums don't take 4 years, 4 or 5 years to make, you know, so yeah. Movies, this documentary is a beast, you know, because it's about World War II history, it's about minority identity, and it's about my travels as making, you know, music. So it's a big, you know, to make that into a really interesting movie has proved to be difficult, but we hope to wrap it up this summer. And then, yeah, it'll be out after that, and then it'll make sense. My album will make sense after.
It's so incredible, and I've been so excited to watch it since I first heard you talk about it at that show, and what I read online. How do you feel the film has become even more important in the last year with the rise that we've seen in anti-Asian hate crime and things going on in the world even more since that album was released? How has the work that you're doing become that much more powerful and important?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of it was focused on immigration before, because you know, Trump was really making it hard for immigration. And there was a lot of like Islamophobia and xenophobia that was really resurfacing. But then I think, so there's an urgency to kind of release it while he was in office. But then ultimately, the more I look at this film, it's really a survey on the Japanese American minority identity in America, like pretty comprehensive, you know? So I think it's very reflective of just changing society. You know, American society is really changing to become like, you know, the America of the past of the 50s, you know, blonde, blue-eyed, all-American guy, you know, that's completely changed. It's really shifting right now. And I think this movie will actually reinforce that idea. I'm sold on this, my worldview that, you know, American, you know, I'm just becoming more comfortable in my own skin as an American, like an Asian American, you know, and that's kind of reflective of society. And then it'll show in this film. So.
Wow. I'm very much looking forward to it. What's the research level that's gone into it? I'm not wanting to talk just about the film, and especially it's nice where it is a companion, but I feel like it's reflected over, this history is reflected over the album, the EP, and the film. What's the research been like for you? I know you've read a lot. You've talked to individuals that were in these camps. Is that correct?
Yeah. You know, it's really interesting. That's a really big question. The research is like, you know, there's nothing groundbreaking that I'm doing, you know, I'm not uncovering anything, but what I'm doing is I'm distilling a message of kind of, you know, solidarity amongst minorities, you know, to uplift us. And then also to help as like Asians to help more marginalized communities, you know, uplift them too. And also, you know, the idea that I still believe the world is getting less and less violent, you know, it's hard to imagine that, you know, like, especially if you're like a Palestinian in Gaza right now, you know, yeah. but even said so, you know, it's like, it's the kind of thing that once you have that peace, when you're not fighting for your life, that you can do things that greatly improve society, like improving the lives of marginalized communities, you know? And I think that's the kind of thing that, I deeply believe in. What was the question? I'm just staring at a light And
oh no, it was just about the research and how you were the people you've talked to and some of the things that you're excited for people to hear.
Yeah, I'm really I want people to get a positive, to feel good about America, like not, especially if you're like a white person and you watch this movie, I don't want you to feel afraid and be like pissed off, like they're, you know, like that your world is ending, you know, like, and I think it's, as an Asian person, if you watch this movie, or a minority, you know, you feel excited about how America is changing, you know, so for, I think it's like a combined message. And a lot of the research, even when I was talking to Japanese American, like survivors, they were talking about how, you know, they're not bitter about it anymore. You know, it's just it's a lot of healing has happened, a lot of forgiveness, but a lot of stuff had to happen so that they could get that healing, you know, and that, yeah. I think that's a message that could always be related to.
No, that's extremely powerful. That's, I this is my third time saying I'm very much looking forward to it. And what was it? How specifically, I guess this isn't really about the music, but what's it like going on a cool cross-country road trip like that with your 15-year-old daughter? That's amazing. I went on a cross-country road trip this year too, and it's one of my favorite memories.
It's beautiful. I mean, America is just so vast. It's beautiful. It's like a wide open space is really like put you in this like humble place, I think. It makes you feel like a part of the universe, you know? And I think that's why people love nature. It's also interesting to be like, oh, America's so vast. But a lot of, you know, if you don't have water, I was like thinking, you know, like a lot of these internment camps are out in the middle of the desert, you know?
Yeah.
And there's like sagebrush and it's pretty uninhabitable unless you have water. And that's and that's how like America is shaped. It's shaped around the rivers and access to water. And that's something I didn't really realize until I was driving around being like, well, nobody lives out here. I wonder why. You know,
yeah, it like opens up your eyes to parts of when you think of specific states, you don't think of those parts of land that are just there and uninhabitable. Like,
yeah, except Vegas, which is kind of weird.
Somehow that
somehow, yeah, somehow.
I wanted to talk briefly about, I love talking to people about their path to music because I find it very interesting. Your path was really interesting to me as well, as you've always classically trained musician, always been like really good at the violin, but you didn't know you could make a living with it. And so then you went to Cornell to study engineering, and that didn't work out. Is that one of the best things that happened to you, would you say?
failing out of Cornell was I think so, because I think I would have been if I had stuck through it, I would have been a very mediocre engineer and still passionate about music. And, you know, it's like I was spending so much time even at Cornell, like playing in a band and working on songs and playing my violin. And it's the kind of thing where, I don't know, I was like 18. I don't even remember what that was like, but it was terrifying to think that you have no future, you know, and to think, I didn't think that music was a future, a possibility until, I don't know. It's a tough life, you know, being a musician, but it's also a great life, you know,
because
you're in touch with your heart. So.
Yeah. And do you remember it all? What was it like that ended up after being, okay, I'm going to really pursue music, and you ended up going to Berkeley and studying film scoring, but what was it like? Was it like a scurry type, desperation type feel to like, okay, now I'm going to make music work? Or what was the process, do you remember, of
when
you changed?
You mean when I got that letter of academic probation?
Yes.
From the engineering department? I think, I was just going to fart around in Ithaca with a band. My dad was like, Kato-san, you must get a degree. And I was like... He's like, if you have a college you want to go to. And of course I was scoping out Berkeley because basically at the time, the only person to teach jazz improvisation on violin was this guy, Matt Glazer, in Boston. And so that was the only place you can go to study jazz improvisation on violin. And so I went there and I just, basically my parents were like, you should just keep going to school and just don't be, you know, what's it called? A bum, you know? And so that's what I did. And no offense to anybody who hasn't gone to college, but, you know, I got my degree, but that was the best thing because now I was so focused on what I wanted to do. I was just spending hours and hours and hours just diving into music and just learning all I could.
Oh, that's incredible. It's cool that you found and someone like Matt Glazer to really the only place you could go for it. And how have those elements that you studied film scoring, you can hear some of that beautiful score in a lot of your songs. How has that like stayed with you in your own music?
Well, I always loved, I never was able to like fuse the two, you know, even my old rock band, Jupiter One, we had orchestral elements, but it wasn't until I started Kishibashi like 10 years ago that I really made that a part of my sound, because it's hard to do to orchestrate to pop music. You know, it takes a lot of effort to coordinate sounds, you know, so, but I could do it. So I decided to just hire myself, you know, to my own thing. It takes, you know, and then and that's how I developed my sound as, it's kind of like hybrid, you know, indie orc avant, orc pop.
I learned that some of the experimentation and things as you developed your sound came from kind of inspiration playing with of Montreal, that it was opened your eyes to things that you could do and ways that you could kind of do more unique things.
Yeah, I was my gateway into of Montreal was that Kevin Barnes, basically the creator of all the music, you know, he's like, I really pushed myself to give him unique sounds that he couldn't do, because he's a genius on every instrument except violin. And so like he doesn't, you know, but he likes strings, you know, so I recorded a bunch of stuff for him, and then I collaborated actually a lot on a couple albums, like heavily, like put up a lot of like, he's like, oh, I want this to sound like Penderecki or Ligeti, and I'm like, okay, no problem, you know. you want something really intense and atonal and cluster and get clustered and stuff, and yeah, so he really pushed me to give him new sounds. So that's when I started looping a lot and really diving into creating new sounds. That's the beginning of Kishibashi. Yeah,
wow, that's so cool. So before when did you start looping? When did you learn to work in that kind of way? When did that idea come?
I had been looping, doing like ambient stuff, like playing, but like actually creating a beat was something I never really did. I think it was until I was touring with Regina Spektor as her violinist. And then she had Reggie Watts, you know who he is?
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, so he opened up. So like we had a whole like European tour with him, and he just showed up with like just his line six looper and like, okay, and a bat and his backpack. That's amazing. And that was like, I don't even think he had a mic. He just like borrowed the house mic. But that guy, that was inspirational to see him just like have a whole show. And I mean, he's funny as shit, you know. So, but like on top of just being a comedian, you know, he could just like, he could play. He was really clever, like with all his loops and stuff like that. And that was, I was like, huh, wow. He's not losing money on tour. No. So that was kind of like an inspiration to be like, oh, let's see what I can do with just my violin and my loops. And originally I had like a sample pad where I'd have like a drum beat, you know, and I'd hit it with my drumstick or something. And then once like it didn't show up, I was like opening up for, I can't remember, Sondre Lurie. Yeah, I was off of, anyways, it didn't show up in Montreal, like my sampler pad. And so I had to like beatbox.
Oh.
And then I like started, I was like, ah, this is way easier. I don't have to haul around that extra thing. And so that's what happens a lot of times. Like even that thing, sometimes you're forced to do stuff. Like even that thing where I go out into the audience and play, you know, acoustically at the end of the show.
Yeah.
You know, that was forced. Cause one time like the venue just like pulled the plug on all their power or something like that, or something happened where we were forced to just finish early.
Oh my gosh.
So I was just like, fuck it. Let's just go out into the crowd and see what we can do.
That's and incredible.
People loved it.
You know? Yeah.
And so now I have to do it every show. It's part of the show now.
That's one of my favorite things. It's a highlight for me that I still remember. You walked right past me, and yeah, it was really cool. And the beatboxing, to hear that, cause I was watching the videos of your concert in Utah and you starting to beatbox, I think probably for the first time that night. and the crowd went crazy. And so hearing that that wasn't originally part of your live act and then finding, oh, this is easier. That's so cool.
It's easy. Yeah, it's not as sharp as like a kick, like in a sampled kick drum, but it's like the idea that you're doing it with your mouth is like pretty cool to see, you know.
Yeah, that's incredible. So. I'd be remiss. My mom is a huge Regina Spektor fan, so I'd love to ask you your favorite Regina Spektor song, or not song, sorry, your favorite Regina Spektor story.
Story. Well, she always picked up dinner, which is really nice. That's incredible. But we never know. We never assume. Once I was okay. This is funny. I mean, she's really sweet and very generous. But we were touring once in Norway, and like it's Norway's. I don't know. It probably still is. This is like the most expensive place to be as an American. You know, with American dollars, just the conversion rate is it just kills you.
Wow.
And so we were going out to dinner, and I remember like the cellist Dan Cho was like so nervous, like because he didn't want to spend any money. So she's like, "Let's go eat somewhere," and then. He's like, I think I'll just have some soup. So he orders like soup for like $20. And then I'm like, fuck it. I'll just get what I want, you know? And then all the time, like Dan couldn't, he was just watching me eat something, you know, and then he's just eating soup, you know, at the end. Cause we didn't, you know, you can't assume that she's going to pick up the tab.
Of course.
She often does. Cause she's really generous. And then finally she picked up the tab and I was just like, win. I took that risk, you know, and he didn't take that risk and he just ate soup when he could have.
So if it wasn't for Regina Spektor in Norway, you may have lost money on tour.
I may have lost money on tour. That's correct.
That's amazing. I love it so much. I appreciate your time. I like to end my interview. I ask the same five questions to close every interview. So I'd love to ask you those. Number one is, if you had to choose between breakfast food, lunch food, or dinner food, you could only eat food from those meal groups for every meal. Which would you choose?
Lunch. I would say lunch.
Okay. Is there a lunch food that hinges on, like a go-to?
Oh, no. I'm just thinking of all the lunches I've had and compared to all the breakfasts I've had. Dinners. You mean you could wake up with one dinner that you had? You mean like steak?
No, you just breakfast, any lunch, dinner, just any dinner food. So like for breakfast, you could only have like what would be like on the dinner menu.
I see. As opposed to lunch, like a sandwich or something.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah.
You could eat steak for lunch too. I mean,
yeah, that's
what's stopping you.
That's where I like slipped in. That's why I choose breakfast. Cause I'm like, oh, you still have like, people love breakfast. Like there's cold pizza, which I don't love. I would sneakily like microwave that.
Oh, cold pizza. Huh.
I love cold pizza. Like when it hasn't been refrigerated, like it's like you're at a pizza, you're at a party where there's pizza.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's been late at night.
Room temperature pizza that's the best.
Nice. Okay. I'm still gonna stick with lunch. I think it's a safe choice.
Safe choice. No, it's absolutely a safe choice. Number two is your go-to karaoke song. I read a funny karaoke story of you playing your own song and only getting 84% on the accuracy score.
Yeah, in Japan they like take karaoke to another level. I mean, they are the creator of karaoke, you know.
Yes. So,
but they they rate you. I definitely did not do so well on Mr. Steak.
That's so funny. So what's your go-to karaoke song?
I don't know. Okay, karaoke really freaks me out because I'm a singer and a performer. So not knowing the lyrics or not nailing something really stresses me out. But I can do Warrant's Cherry Pie pretty well.
Okay, that's a good one.
Or I could do, you know, Aha, Take On Me. That's easy for me.
So, oh, that's great.
It's a crowd pleaser too. Yeah, because I can hit that high note, you know, so.
I love it. Three is a guilty pleasure you have on tour or on the road.
You mean like Broadway songs?
Yeah, that's perfect. What specific show?
Oh, I don't know. I just like that old fashioned like Camelot and like a lot of like Leonard Bernstein ones.
That's like, perfect.
I don't mind listening to Liza Minnelli, you know. And I mean a lot of musicians hate, you know, they hate Broadway music, you know.
Oh no, I love it. So you saying that, I'm like, okay, that's a pleasure of mine. That's not a guilty pleasure for me.
It's guilty for a lot of musicians.
Number four is who's a group that you would love to, that's not currently together, that you'd love to have one more EP from?
Oh, like Led Zeppelin or something?
Yeah, that's
perfect. You mean that are still alive? Like yeah. John Bonham's dead, but.
Well, I haven't banned any. I haven't done that because usually people go Beatles or things. So it's basically just the first group that comes to your mind that you're like, I'd love to hear one more.
Oh, I project. See. Because like by the end of Led Zeppelin, I don't know if I'd want another album necessarily of their career. Are you talking about like a band that disbanded in the height of their like creative, like the Beatles, I guess?
Yeah.
At the height. Hmm. Nope, can't really think. Well, I don't know. What have other people said?
There's been, let me think. There's been a lot of Beatles. We've gone some One Direction a few times. I'm trying to think, and that like came from like the most surprising person said One Direction.
What about like Nirvana or something? I feel like they could have.
Nirvana, yeah, Nirvana. I think that's a great some one. Stuff. That's common. And then the last question, number five, is who's an interesting guest that you recommend I have on the Road Trip Playlist podcast?
Oh, talk to Reggie Watts.
I would love that. Yeah, that's so good. And I can talk to him about the tour that he went on with just a backpack and borrowed mic.
Yeah, and then tell him that, ask him how, okay, basically he didn't show up for half the tour, and that's how I got my start because I opened up for Regina Spektor. Ask him why he didn't show up because I don't know, but thanks. You know what I mean?
Oh, so you don't know why he didn't show up?
Yeah, I don't know. It's something like he didn't get on the plane and I don't know. It's like something medical. I don't know, but
wow.
Regina was kind of pissed off about it. That's all I know,
so. Well, thank you, Reggie Watts, because it helped launch Kishibashi.
Which yeah, that was the start of Kishibashi. So
that's incredible. Well, thank you so much for your time. I can't thank you enough. I really appreciate it, and I can't wait to hear more from your music and also the movie to come.
Cool. Thanks for having me.
Yep. Have a wonderful day. Talk to you another time, I hope.
Thank you again for listening. Please make sure to go out and listen to Kishibashi's music and especially his new EP, Emigrant. Follow, rate, and review the Road Trip Playlist podcast. Stay tuned next week for a great interview with Bowling for Soup.